This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Welcome to another edition of Layla Weighs In here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate your questions, your comments, and you could reach me at radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. I've got a question from a colleague of mine, Kristen. She's an RD. She is practiced in integrative and functional medicine. And she has a question on lab interpretation. Some values like iron studies, B12, folic acid levels, the breakdown of a complete blood count, all of that, testing for methylmalonic acid, which kind of goes hand in hand with the B12, and I'll get into that, and the ranges that may be used in functional medicine, and which tests do I find more reliable. And then also different biomarkers for checking prediabetes, what are the optimal lab ranges for A1C, fasting insulin, and also for leptin. Leptin could be an important biomarker, but the jury's still out because low leptin levels are not great and high leptin levels are not great, so it's not a very useful test, but I'm going to get into all of these, starting with the B12 and folic acid levels. Now, typically, after doing a complete blood count, a CBC, to see if there's any iron deficiency anemia or something like that, or other types of anemia like pernicious, we would find low B12. We like to see B12 levels, and I know the normal range starts at about 150 or 200. In integrative and functional medicine, we do find that quite low. I know we like to see levels closer to 600 or above, in the 600 to 900 range. Folic acid levels, definitely over 15, is good. Many practitioners would argue that higher would be better. And now, methylmalonic acid, or MMA, a lot of practitioners who check B12 also check methylmalonic acid because they think it's more specific. And let me explain what methylmalonic acid is. It's a substance produced in very small amounts and is necessary for human metabolism and energy production. It's a step of metabolism, and what happens is if there's not enough B12 available, then MMA concentration begins to rise. So there's an inverse relationship. When you see a low B12, you're going to check methylmalonic acid, and you will see that it's high. MMA concentration begins to rise, resulting in an increase of MMA in the blood and urine. So the measurement of elevated amounts of methylmalonic acid in the blood or urine serves as a sensitive and early indicator of B12 deficiency. I think that's why a lot of integrative and functional practitioners find this very specific test useful, because it's a sensitive and early indicator of B12 deficiency. I think more in mainstream medicine, the methylmalonic acid test, the MMA test, is used when the patient already is presenting with B12 deficiency symptoms, such as tingling, numbness in the extremities, neurological issues, things of that nature. So I know we do like to test MMA. So that is absolutely useful. So different biomarkers for checking prediabetes. What are the optimal lab ranges for A1C? I think optimal for A1C is probably 5.0. But you know what, Kristen? I'm finding that the GlycoMark test is even more specific because, you know, the hemoglobin A1C test is actually an average of blood sugar over a 12-week period. So it doesn't take into consideration the variability of blood pressure. How high does it go? How low does it go? It doesn't tell us about the instability and what if it's very wide ranges of blood sugar. I find the GlycoMark test is very beneficial in this regard. And lately, just over the past few months in my own practice, I've been requesting it more and more, the GlycoMark test, in addition to the A1C. I think it gives us a much clearer picture of the variability of blood sugar, especially in a type 2 diabetic who's made changes in diet and or have been given diabetes medications or had their diabetes medication dosages changed to see what it's doing to their blood sugar highs and lows, the variability, the ranges. Now, for a fasting insulin, we like to see, I know that the normal range is like below 15 or 16. It may even be higher depending on the reference lab that you're using. I like to see fasting insulins around 5, you know, anywhere between 4 or 6. Now, there's a caveat to that. When the insulin is higher than 10, I believe that may point to hyperinsulinism, but let me explain. A fasting insulin is not going to be the whole story, not in any way, shape, or form, although it is helpful. If you find a high fasting insulin, say 20, you know there's hyperinsulinism. You almost know there is insulin resistance. Okay, so that's a sign right there. But a fasting insulin of even 8 or 9, there may be a question mark there. And again, we can't guess because the real gold standard is a 5-hour glucose tolerance that also measures insulin levels at the time it measures blood sugar. And you may find somebody with a fasting insulin of, say, 9 or 10 or 11 that you find by the second and third, the fourth hour, their insulin levels go way up. And, you know, insulin levels that go up above 40, 60, all of that within a discrete period of time, that's part of the criteria for metabolic syndrome or definitely hyperinsulinism, insulin resistance. So I like to see fasting insulins really around 4, 5, 6. Now, the other caveat of a low fasting insulin is, when would we otherwise see a low fasting insulin besides healthy blood sugar levels, somebody on a lower carb diet, somebody whose pancreas doesn't need to secrete all that insulin because they're not eating so many carbs, that the pancreas is pretty stable in its secretion of insulin and not enough is required? Well, you might see lower insulins, less than 6 or 5, in a later stage diabetic. Somebody who has undiagnosed type 2 diabetes, whose pancreas is now becoming worn out from secreting all that insulin, right? From secreting all that insulin over years, maybe even decades, and now it's worn out and it's secreting less and less and less insulin. So of course you'd look at this low fasting insulin and compare it with their blood sugars. Do they have corresponding very high blood sugars? Well, there's your answer. This patient may now be a later stage diabetic and on the cusp of having to administer insulin because that pancreas in that patient is now becoming pooped. So this is why a fasting insulin is really not enough in my estimation. So leptin, Kristen is asking, what ranges do we use for leptin? There are a lot of different functional tests that a lot of integrative practitioners use, high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, A1C, besides looking at BMI and all of those kind of things. High-sensitive C-reactive protein is a marker of inflammation primarily in the arteries, in the vascular system. So it's actually a good marker for either beginning or inflammation in the coronary arteries. Now, in terms of leptin, I'll tell you, I've not used it as a range. I know Dr. Hoffman is not, because I asked him when I got your question. So here's the thing about leptin. When a lab measures your leptin levels, several factors play into how your doctor will interpret the results. For example, age, gender, weight will all factor into what a normal leptin level range is for you. In addition, leptin has only been looked at in the research for a short period of time, only since 1994. And as the scientific inquiry continues into the importance of leptin, the reference ranges for what's normal, high, or low within that could all change. And further, because we may think that having high leptin is a good result, for many, it's just the opposite because it can signal leptin resistance, which is very, very similar to insulin resistance. Now, leptin comes from the Greek word meaning thin. It's known as the satisfaction, the satiety hormone. It mainly acts as a regulator of our total body's energy stores. It's a critical player when we feel like we've had enough to eat because leptin has bound to receptors in the region of our brains responsible for hunger and appetite. Leptin also senses changes in the amount of energy you've stored and can also increase the amount of calories your body burns to keep your weight set within a range of pounds. Now, leptin in the body is secreted by our fat cells, which release the hormone while we sleep. A small amount of leptin is released from stomach tissue, and there are leptin receptors in the gut as well. Now, here's the thing. We're secreting leptin when we have enough fat on our body to secrete it. It basically tells our brain in our individual human universe, our individual biochemistry, that we've had enough. There are enough calories here. There are enough fat stores. We don't need as much. Be less hungry. On the other hand, on a thinner person who has less fat storage, there is less leptin being secreted. So that's really another criteria. And the most important caveat is the level of body fat. And leptin mainly comes from fat cells. And the more fat in the cells, the more leptin that is released. But in a person who has insulin resistance, they will also likely have corresponding leptin resistance. So that's why I don't find leptin ranges all that very useful. Now, Having said that, let me give you what I've read on ranges for leptin. A young woman's total leptin range is from 0.50 to 137, with middle ranges between 4.48 and 11 micrograms per liter. And adult women ages 20 to 80 have leptin ranges that goes somewhere between 0.46 and 1.49. And really it depends on BMI. Besides the level of body fat, leptin results are highly sensitive to the time you take the test. Remember, leptin is being released while we sleep. So leptin somewhat follows a circadian pattern with peak expression around 2 a.m. So a single measurement in the morning or early afternoon may provide an informative reading, and gender also plays a huge role in what's considered a high leptin result. This is where women and men differ, among other things. Women's leptin levels are generally higher than men's, and for children's, their age also plays a role. Now let's talk about leptin resistance. The fact that people who are obese have more leptin, right? Because they have more fat cells secreting leptin. So the fact that people who are obese have more leptin than people who are thin suggests that obesity causes a resistance to leptin. This means the hormone either can't reach the receptors in your brain to dial back your appetite and upgrade your calorie burning, or there is a problem with how the brain responds to leptin. In addition, as we age, we have fewer leptin receptors, which, guess what? Makes us prone to gain weight. So what does a test result possibly or probably mean? Now, in the obese, decreased leptin levels may indicate some degree of deficiency, while increased concentrations are thought to be associated with resistance to the effects of leptin. And that goes to what I said earlier in this podcast. Low levels may be bad and high levels may be bad. Most obese people will have increased levels, but about 10% may have some degree of leptin deficiency. That's why leptin has not become the magic bullet which it was once hoped to be for any weight loss trials. So, and very rarely, significantly decreased leptin levels may indicate an inherited leptin deficiency linked to severe obesity. So, and leptin secretion follows a circadian pattern, as I said earlier, meaning that the concentration in the blood will vary throughout a 24-hour time period. If leptin is reaching its peak at 2 a.m., nobody's going for a blood test at 2 a.m., and would that be considered a high number then? Or it's not very, very specific. And women normally have a high leptin level than men. Leptin levels are also increased during pregnancy and may be significantly increased in women with gestational diabetes, that's pregnancy diabetes, or preeclampsia, a potentially fatal condition. The test is not used to monitor any of those conditions. So, and the usefulness of leptin results in a medical setting, especially in evaluating excess or deficient amounts of the hormone, is really yet to be fully established. And I think that's why it's not a very common test. For example, somebody with a rare inherited deficiency may benefit from leptin replacement therapy, but there's not yet sufficient data in the literature to determine whether or not a person with mild deficiency would also benefit from targeted treatment. How do we know that that additional leptin replacement isn't causing leptin resistance? So, some of the other topics that have been or are being studied in association with leptin include its contribution to inflammation and atherosclerosis, or conversely, its protection from atherosclerosis. See, it kind of goes both ways. Other things being studied and in association with leptin is increase with gestational diabetes, its role in fertility, association with depression, stress, and anxiety, leptin's role in maintaining glucose levels, and its interaction with insulin, and association between leptin levels, weight loss, and hunger. So, again, You want to classify if the patient is underweight, normal weight, overweight, obese, right? And leptin is not typically performed in doctor's offices. It's not offered by most laboratories, but a reference laboratory, it will likely be sent to a reference laboratory or one that more integrative and functional medical practitioners might use, whether it's a doctor's data, a Genova, or some other test lab. So people will ask, what can I do to lower or increase leptin levels? Leptin levels will often decrease when an obese person loses weight, right? Because they're shedding fat. And increase when a person becomes obese, but they do not otherwise respond to lifestyle changes. How is leptin deficiency treated? Again, this is a rare inherited disorder, that is, leptin deficiency is. Replacement therapy has been successful in addressing obesity. However, not enough data at this time to support its routine use for other leptin deficiencies. Now, are there other adipokines besides leptin? Although leptin was the first adipocyte, fat cell cytokine or adipokine identified, many others have been discovered. And the two that have been most extensively investigated are resistin, which increases insulin resistance, and adiponectin, which lowers it. Adiponectin is desirable. Resistin is increased and adiponectin is decreased in obesity. They also have opposite effects on inflammation. Resistin increases inflammation while adiponectin decreases it. Another recently discovered adipokine is visfatin, which is elevated in type 2 diabetes, may play a role in elevating insulin levels. But look, I think, and the reason I've not really looked at leptin, is it is so related to insulin, high insulin, insulinism, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, that I feel like it's kind of a duplicate, or it's not as necessary when we already have fasting insulin, insulin levels on a 5-hour glucose tolerance test, other measures of insulin like C-peptide, fructosamine. I like C-peptide better than fructosamine, and all of that, and corresponding high or low blood glucose levels. So all of these are helpful. I hope this was helpful in answering your question about B12 and methylmalonic acid and these important functional testing methods. And I thank you for joining me on another edition of Layla Weighs In here on Intelligent Medicine.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.